Imagine making a car so daring and luxurious that you think it will change the automotive world forever. A luxury sedan with a V12 engine, built by a group of genius engineers who just wowed the world with the release of a massively successful roadster. A unicorn car that would take its maker from the middle of the pack to number one. Money is spent, a lot of money. The makers believe it's a car that will compete with BMW, Mercedes, and Lexus. A car that will launch a whole new luxury brand. And then an economic collapse, so big the impacts are felt for over two decades. The luxury sedan never gets produced. The project, it's canceled. That V12 engine never sees the light of day. In less than a year, the wonder car becomes a ghost. The badge is never launched, never seen, never talked about, never admitted to even being developed. That's the story of a Mahdi. In the late 1980s, Mazda, one of the smaller Japanese car companies, took a big swing and tried to create a luxury car brand. Mainly the success of their roadster, the Mazda Miata, and the successes of companies like Toyota making the Lexus. But it set its sights too high and wasted almost $400 million in the process. Today on Pass Gas, the Mahdi, Mazda's luxury brand that never was and to this day remains a mystery. How did Mazda go from zoom zoom to doom and gloom?
Pass Gas Podcast. It's about cars, it's not about forts.
Zoom zoom, muchachos.
Yeah. that was their tagline, which was really weird.
Yeah, there was like that one the fall ad campaign of 1989 where they just had machine gun noises. No accompanying visuals, just machine gun noises over the Mazda logo.
Well, they got what's his name? Who's the big
Steven Seagal?
No, the big drug dealer.
Tim Allen?
Yeah, they got Tim Allen and he kicked down the door and he was just it was like really like smoky, you know, like really like a lot of atmosphere in the commercial.
And they're saying, "Who's there?" There's like vague insurgents.
Yeah, it's like Lexus and Infiniti and like just like this boardroom of all the luxury brands. Mercedes is there, BMW is there. And Tim Allen just kicked down the door wearing an Abe Lincoln top hat.
And they say, "Who's there?" And then he goes,
"Yeah," he goes, and they were like, "Oh no." And then he kicks in the door and he goes, "Zoom, zoom, muchachos." And just like wrecks them all with a Tommy gun.
Yeah, the 90s were weird, man.
Yeah, it was weird.
Super weird.
I'm excited about this one. I'm a big Mazda fan. I think Mazda's a really cool car company. And if you look at a lot of the Japanese brands, you know, Toyota, they all have like a luxury affiliate.
Yeah. Yeah. They had, you know, Toyota's famously got Lexus, great car company. Nissan, they founded Infiniti. Honda had Acura, of course.
Yeah. And so Mazda's really the only one who doesn't have one, and I think we're going to find out today. It's not for lack of trying.
That's right.
But can you actually see, like, a Mahdi is, like, the weakest name out of all of those. Like, Lexus is sick. Acura, you know, conjures up, like drafting tools and, like, yeah, like, you know, like, accurate stuff. I don't know. Yeah. But a Mahdi sounds like a cousin, like... George Amadi's coming to the family picnic, like, put on your best clothes.
Or Amadi sounds like an R&B lady from like the late 90s, early 2000s that R. Kelly kept prisoner.
Oh, like Ashanti?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, oh, there's Aaliyah and Amadi, and like R. Kelly married Amadi when she was 12.
Right, right. I think Amadi to me sounds like a fake car company from Grand Theft Auto.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, that's the Amadi G111 or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, welcome to Past Gas. This is not an R. Kelly show. This is not Grand Theft Auto show. This is an automotive history show. I'm your host, Nolan Sykes, joined as always by Joe Weber.
Fire up that wink juice.
And James Pumphrey.
I don't know what's going on with my dog. That's my new one.
How is your dog, James?
I don't think she's doing well right now. She is alarmed.
Oh, she's barking. I thought she was like, you know, whining or something.
No, she's got groomed. She looks real cute, but she is.
She's on one today?
She is suspicious about something that's going on outside.
How are you doing, Nolan? No one ever asked Nolan how he's doing.
Yeah, no one ever asked Nolan how he's doing.
It's all right. It's Friday after a long shoot week. We've shot a lot of content. I feel like I say that every time we record this podcast. But, we just shot, like, I shot six wheelhouses this week.
Six wheelhouses. Yeah. I am, like, 0% sarcasm, 100% genuine. Very impressed by that. I think you should be very proud of yourself. And I know Joe's on Wheelhouse now. And you guys did a great job.
Yeah. Yeah. All the credit goes to Joe, I think. I'm just the mouth. Joe really made all the gears turn to get those scripts ready in time.
Oh,
so.
You put your stank on them, too. You had that last polish finish
yeah,
on
dude.
It.
All right. I did it all, guys. Yeah, you're right.
There's tons of your goop all over that.
All right, let's get into it.
All right.
To understand why Amati failed, we have to look at Japan's economy in the 1980s. We're going to have to go a little Big Short on you today. But how did this economic downturn affect Japanese automakers? Why was it so bad? And how did it affect Mazda specifically? In 1992, Japan's price bubble burst after 5 years of growth. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that both real estate and stock prices were inflated during this time. The most famous example of this inflation was a real estate assessment done at the height of Japan's bubble. This assessment valued one piece of land in the heart of Tokyo as more expensive than the entire state of California. Another report in the New York Times valued all the land in Japan at $13.47 trillion. That was more than the value of all the land in the United States. And to be clear, this is not money being spent, it's the value being estimated. This led to inflation and companies thinking they had more capital than was actually there.
I imagine the person who's like assessing this is like Yosemite Sam.
Yibbidi-yibbidi. Wait, that's Porky Pig.
Like, I don't know why, but it's just like somebody going like, yeah, this is worth more than the whole U.S. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, definitely. Totally.
So you can imagine when the bubble burst, many Japanese people were out a lot of money. In fact, the burst bubble had negative effects in the Japanese economy for over 20 years. It led to what is now known as the lost decade in Japan. During the height of the bubble, Japanese car makers were having a bit of a moment. The cars that were made and developed in this era in Japan in the late 80s and early 90s were all high quality and developing new technology rapidly. Some might say putting American car makers to shame. I would definitely say that. This high for Japanese car makers led to the creation of badges like Lexus and Acura. It also led to smaller companies thinking they had a shot at luxury badges.
I mean, even now, you look back at, you know, late 80s and early to mid 90s Japanese cars, they're worth a lot of money still.
Yeah.
It was really a moment for cars that will be a chapter in the history of automobiles forever. You know what I mean? Like, so many amazing automobiles happened in this time in Japan.
Yeah, we're talking the Daewoo Lanos.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it in our Midnight Club episodes a while back, but like, there was just so much money in Japan. Everyone had a surplus. Parents were out there just buying their kids like Nissan 300ZXs. If the kid crashed it, they'd just go ahead and buy another one, like no problem. there's just so much extra money going around that could fuel the development of all these cars, like, you know, all the R32 to the R34 GTR, you know?
I mean, at this time, just look at Nissan, okay? Nissan had a Silvia turbocharged four-cylinder coupe. They had the 300ZX. They had the Skyline, which is, that is two twin turbo V6 motors, two different twin turbo V6 motors under one roof.
No, not even that. The 300Z was the V6, and then the Skylines, they had the RB26, right? So they had inline, they had both V6 yeah. and inline, they had V6 and inline twin turbocharged engines.
That'll never happen again.
That's so stupid. That'll never happen again. I never thought about that. Yeah. That is really
that's
dumb.
Crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So like nowadays, it's like a car company won't even develop their own twin turbo six cylinder motor. It's like multiple companies share the same engine.
Right.
But like Nissan at the same time had the RB and the
VG 30. DETT?
Yeah. So like they like it'll never happen again. It's like one of those situations where it's just like, what the fuck was going on? This is insane.
So you could say, James, that Japanese car companies peaked in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And then once that bubble burst, there was a lot of collateral damage. One of those companies, Mazda, was hit the hardest. With the collapse of the asset bubble stopping the development of a Mahdi in its tracks, a luxury car that never was because of some real estate that was never really worth the price. Look, man, I don't care how nice that land is. It'll never be worth more than California.
I'm stealing your milkshake. So that explains what was happening in Japan at the time, but the economy in the U.S. also impacted the Japanese car market in the 80s and 90s. The U.S. market had a big effect on why and how Mazda decided to try its hand at a luxury brand. To better understand a Mahdi, we need to understand a little bit of history. Mainly, how did American economics and a policy influenced by Chrysler lead to Japanese automakers going into the luxury car market? Way, way back in 1973, in the United States, there was a little thing called the oil crisis. We made a shirt about it. You can buy it at donutmedia.com. Lots of new merch coming. Super excited. Join our mailing list to make sure you don't miss any of it. The oil crisis started in October 1973 when Saudi Arabia declared an oil embargo on the United States. By the end of the embargo in March 1974, the price of oil had risen almost 300%. With U.S. prices rising even higher than in other countries. People were paying a lot for gas and were sick of cars that had bad fuel economy. Americans wanted economic cars, but American car companies like GM, Ford, and Chrysler weren't making these kinds of cars. They had not prepared for this shift in consumer demands. This led to all of the American automakers losing market share to Japanese brands. This also led to American automakers losing a lot of money. When big American automakers started hemorrhaging dollars, you can be sure that their next move will be a visit to our nation's capital, specifically the halls of Congress. Chrysler was upset about losing market share to Japanese automakers, and the company's lobbyists were highly effective in communicating that upsetness to our lawmakers. They convinced the U.S. government to bail them out. Chrysler got a $2 billion loan guarantee from Congress, and the Chrysler Loan Guarantee Act was signed by President Jimmy Carter. This saved Chrysler from bankruptcy, but it also led to a public discussion about the best way to protect the American auto industry. In the 80s, President Reagan negotiated with the Japanese government and got them to agree to a voluntary export cap, limiting the number of imported vehicles from Japan to the United States to 1.68 million vehicles per year. That may seem like a big number, but at this point, Japan was making most of its money in the United States off of economy cars. So like that business model is like sell as many cars as you can. There's a very low profit margin on cheap cars. So when you put a cap on how many you can sell, you have to like start thinking of a different way to do things. Mm-hmm. I mean, the story of Lexus is one of my favorite stories.
Well, also, too, it wasn't just like, oh, Reagan negotiated with the Japanese government. He was like, strong-armed them into putting a cap.
Yeah, it was more like how the mob asks to protect the corner shop.
Yeah, it's like, hey, you know what? Like, I think we should put a cap on how many vehicles you can import.
And they're like, no, we want to sell a bunch of them.
No, I think that, like, that's probably a pretty good idea because, like, we got Ford. And so, like, you?
Well, just for some context, you know, the United States imposed a huge tariff on Japanese electronics, like computers and televisions and all that kind of stuff. So, like, the auto industry, I'm sure they were like, hey, if you don't do this voluntarily, we're going to, like, impose a 100% tariff on your cars. And Japan was like, obviously, we can't do that. So that's what that voluntary, quote-unquote, voluntary restriction is. So much of the free market, right? Dude, God, this honestly makes me so mad, this story, every time, because it's like, the Americans, we were skating by so easily. Like, because, like, the customers didn't really know any better. It's just like, hey, here's, like, these really bad cars.
Just terrible. They're making such a terrible product.
And then the Japanese come in with their economy cars. At first, they weren't great. Granted, they weren't. They were economy cars, but they got better over time. In, like, the course of, like, 10 years, these economy cars started getting really good. And then that's when the car companies got scared. And this whole thing about, you know, quote unquote free market, but really it's not, comes into play. It just makes me so mad every time we talk about this thing.
All right. Anyway, not only was there a need to create a luxury market in the United States because of the import limit, but there was also an increase in demand for luxury cars in Japan as Japanese consumers became wealthier. This meant there was an intense competition between all of the Japanese automakers, and everyone wanted to be the best. There's now potential to be selling a luxury badge that did well in the US and Japan. Not only that, but because of the asset price bubble, all of these auto companies were able to get endless amounts of capital to develop new cars. And with this competition, each car was more innovative and exotic than the last. It was a perfect climate for any smaller car company to try their hand at bigger, better, more luxurious cars. It all felt too big to fail. Cue ominous music.
You're not supposed to read that, James.
If they don't want me to read it, then why is it in the thing? Okay? Cue ominous music. Gavin, cue it!
This is what you were talking about before. Like, instead of companies trying to one-up each other and cut corners, they're actively trying to make a better car than the other one, and it created some of the coolest cars, at least from our lifetime.
Bro, like, this is one of the most important moments in automotive history. Like, this is just when, like, they got so good that it forced everybody else to get so good. Japanese cars of this era, because of all of this, got so good that American cars got better, German cars got better. Every single car company was forced to, like, rise to the top. And, like, and, you know, like, one of the reasons, like, that embargo happened, because it was like, everyone was like, yo, chill out.
Yeah, they set a new benchmark.
Yeah, it's like, can you just, like, relax?
Yeah, our car companies will die if you keep going like this.
Yeah, like, dude, we got a good thing going on over here. Can you just...
Dude, we just rolled out this K-car platform. We got high hopes for it. We got 17 different shades of tan we're going to paint it in.
Yo, I got a 7.8 liter V8 that makes 110 horsepower and gets -4 miles to the gallon. Can you just chill, please?
Like the kid in the class that throws the curve on the test.
Yeah. Japan threw the curve.
Yeah.
Japan asked the teacher at the end of class, like, is there any homework? You didn't, ma'am, you didn't collect our homework from last night.
Oh, come on, Nissan. Get out of here, dude. Oh, maybe after class, Nissan.
Yeah. I'm just tariff, bro.
Yeah.
Yeah, they threw the curve. That's a great analogy. They threw
That's a
curve.
Great analogy. Takes me back to my bad math days. All right.
I think Nolan needs therapy.
Enter the underdog. In a business where underdogs almost never prospered, Mazda was a small, scrappy company, but they wanted to be bigger. They had less money and resources than Toyota and Nissan, but those bigger companies also showed that a high level of success was possible, and their goal was to become Japan's third major automaker. Mazda had big dreams, an insane strategy, and not a lot of money to accomplish their goals. What could go wrong, I ask? Before we talk about the Amati's failure, we have to talk about one of Mazda's successful projects, the Miata. In the spring of 1989, Mazda launched the Miata, and it was a hit, spurring on the sense of optimism within the company that their experimentation was working. In 1989, the MX-5 Miata debuted. Mazda had design proposals from both its Japanese and American offices. Mazda ended up going with the American design. This became the MX-5. The design was similar to a classic British sports car, with its rear-wheel drive and engine in the front. When the Miata was officially released in 1990, it lightly resembled a 60s-era Lotus Elan remade for the modern era. At launch, the MX-5 Miata was powered by a 116-horsepower, 1.6-liter engine, and was solely available with a 5-speed manual transmission. I'm a manual guy. I like shifting the gears myself. I'm a real driver.
Nothing like that fourth pedal, am I right, guys?
Yeah. I got all four pedals. I use all five of my legs when I drive.
It could also be had with power windows and aluminum wheels and AC.
And speakers in the headrests.
Stuff that makes a car comfortable. But no matter how it was equipped, the MX-5 Miata was extremely lightweight by modern standards. Basically a great roadster that, when it was released, won numerous accolades, including Automobile Magazine's 1990 Automobile of the Year and placing on Car and Driver's 10 Best list from 1990 to 1992. It's a good car. Great car.
I'd say legendary.
The success of the Miata got in Mazda's head. It made the little company think it could continue to reach and grow and profit off a luxury badge. After all, no one thought Mazda could build a roadster, and the Miata had been a hit. Clearly, Mazda could do no wrong. They were about to fly a little too close to the sun, with an endeavor that was appropriately named Project Pegasus.
They were about to fly too close to the sunburst yellow.
Oh.
James. Yeah.
Pegasus didn't fly into the sun, did it?
No, Pegasus was a horse with feathers. That was Icarus. Yeah, you're right. If it was called Project Icarus.
It had wings. It had feathers on the wings. Yeah. Pegasus wasn't just a horse with feathers.
That's called going to, what was that, the third base or something? Skipping a step in the joke, James?
Oh, A to D?
I went A to C on that one, I think.
Yeah.
Horse with feathers.
But if you don't mention, like, a horse with feathers is worse than a horse.
Yeah.
It's just like kind of a pokier horse. It's gotta have the wings.
A messier horse.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more of this story, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Mazda had proven it could punch above its weight class, and now the company was eager to zoom into the luxury business. But what went into the development of Mazda's luxury car brand? Who was in charge? How was the relationship between the Japanese and American branches working for Mazda? Who ultimately took the fall? Mazda got started on designing a new luxury brand and appointed Dick Colliver, a 20-year Mazda veteran, to head the project. It was codenamed Pegasus and announced to the press in August of 1991. At this announcement, Mazda said it would launch its new luxury badge in the first quarter of 1994. At the time, Kenichi Yamamoto was the head of Mazda and encouraged the Pegasus team. Yamamoto was the one who wanted Mazda to continue to grow and expand. He had been the one who approved the plans for the Miata and pushed the Roadster into existence. Now, He wanted Mazda to grow and make it to the next level as a company. Project Pegasus got to work.
They started hot gluing feathers all over that horse.
And then like someone walked in, they were like, "Time out. What are you doing?" And they were like, "Oh, you know what? I think we may have taken this too literally." They were like, "Yeah, you think?"
"Yeah, we got to put this horse down, I guess.
You're supposed to design a car." And they were like, "Oh, yeah, you know what? That makes a lot of sense."
"Look, horses don't go downstairs. They go upstairs and that's it."
"Yeah."
They started working on a luxury sedan they would call a Mahdi. The plan was to use a V12 engine using pieces from Mazda's existing V6 program. At this time, I want to point out that the Mazda V6 was like awesome. Like it's like a very small displacement V6, like found in like the MX6 and I think some MX3s, but like low displacement engines with a lot of cylinders are like one of my favorite things. And the V6 that Mazda had at this point was super sick. And in my head, this V12 is awesome.
Just two of them put together?
Yeah.
Hey, do you think it's possible to have the shape of like an airplane engine? You know how the cylinders are all like in a circle? Kind of like that?
Engine like that, yeah.
And put that inside of a rotary engine?
No.
A three-cylinder engine inside of a rotary engine. Can it be made?
No. That doesn't make any sense. It was 1991, and by 1992, Mazda would announce the discontinuation of a Mahdi. The company was flying high, so what went wrong?
Mazda had designers and engineers working on a Mahdi in Japan and the U.S. They had a track record with the Miata. When the team for a Mahdi started working on the car, there were two branches, one in Japan and one in the U.S., naturally. From the beginning, there was tension between the Mazda offices in the U.S. and the main office in Japan. For example, one of the Mazda plants in the U.S., where Mazda built cars to avoid import restrictions, had quality control problems. The Japanese tried to blame this on the Americans, but soon they started building cars at their plant in Japan and had the exact same problems.
Oh, pot calling the kettle black.
Not only that, but Mazda was a small company with not a lot of extra cash. One former employee said that Mazda wouldn't even pay for new notebooks for the engineers. Come on, man. And to top it all off, Mazda was working on several other brands, and many thought stretching itself too thin and causing brand confusion. All of these factors meant that in 1992, a Mahdi shut its doors, bowing to economic pressure. John O'Dell wrote in the Los Angeles Times in October of 1992, quote,
"Mazda Motors of America said Monday that it's canceling plans to launch its Mahdi luxury car division in the United States, full stop."
And that was that. A Mahdi was no more. Mazda would never mention the car again. One of the strangest things about the whole saga is that to this day, Mazda denied it ever happened. Maybe that's because in Japanese culture, a failure like a Mahdi is seen as losing face. And Mazda did not want to lose face. Never want to lose your face. In 2019, one journalist was even told not to ask the company about the luxury badge because it was still a, quote, touchy subject. Or maybe because it was just such a failure. One paper estimated that Mazda had spent no less than 50 billion yen, about $400 million in 1992 dollars, on the brand. Either way, it's been over 20 years, and Mazda will still not admit to what happened.
I mean, why didn't they just do like a three-cylinder engine inside of a rotary engine and save some money?
A Mahdi is the name of like really fancy violin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The violin has, weirdly enough, a three-cylinder airplane engine inside of a rotary engine.
Oh. Wow, that's such a smart design.
That's what makes the violin sound so good.
I just realized, so a Mahdi is a conjugation of Amato, and part of my family, their last name is D'Amato, So
you'd be Joe D'Amato in a Mazda Amati.
Yay. I'm a notary.
I'll come to your house.
All I need is your signature.
I'll let you borrow the stamp for 75 bucks. Mazda developed so much for the Amati and ended up throwing most of the work away. However, some of the development for the Amati was recycled. What happened to the parts of the Amati that did make it into development? Well, since Mazda will not admit the Amati ever existed, everything is conjecture from car enthusiasts and journalists, but we can make some guesses. One of the big saves for the Amati badge was in 1994, the Yunos 800, the car planned to be released under the Amati badge, was renamed the Mazda Millennia.
Huh.
And sold in America. The Millennia is famous for loving Harry Potter, wearing skinny jeans, doing side parts.
Yeah, you know, with the context of it being a possible luxury car, it looks very much like, it looks like a lower level Lexus, like an ES. It looks like a Lexus ES.
Mazda's design language at this time was like really weird. Like it looked really great in like on the RX-7 and the Miata. But like translating it to like their compact cars and especially their sedans, like that kind of like low slung, very aerodynamic like design language just looked kind of melty. The Millennia replaced the Mazda 929 as the brand's flagship car in America. It did not go unnoticed how luxury this non-luxury car was, with reviews noting the Millennia's quality well above the rest of Mazda's fleet. Even in its advertising, Mazda said, we put the money into the car and not into luxury, into a luxury division and all that overhead.
Don't look this up or anything.
Yeah, so we did that on purpose because, like, we're not going to start a luxury brand. That would be stupid and dumb. So we just did this.
The tagline for the Millennia is like, like a luxury horse with feathers.
That didn't fly too close to the sun this time.
We'll get back to more past gas, but right now, a word from our sponsors.
Many people also think that the second generation Mazda Sentia that launched in 1995 is the Amati 1000 body repurposed with a Mazda JV6 and the Sentia mechanical foundation. The V12 engine Mazda was developing for Amati is a different story. They were already gearing up to build the Amati V12 engine and had the assembly line ready to go. Mazda wanted to find another way to use this engine. The American division of Mazda drew up a V12 powered 2+2 that was fully mocked up. But Ford, who had bought controlling shares in Mazda, canceled the project because Ford ruins everything fun. The V12 engine was fully shelved and never seen by the public. However, the website Jalopnik has noted that the proposed V12 concept strongly resembles the Mazda RX-8, which went into production in 2003, which means basically we have never seen the V12, but we may have seen the car.
Crazy. Can you imagine a V12 powered RX-8?
I'm half hard. Like literally, like it moved. The V6 in the Mazda MX-6 is 2.5 liters. It would have been a 5 liter V12 RX-8.
Wow. What?
Ooh. Aaron, our buddy Aaron, Aaron Parker, swears that the RX-8 is one of the best handling cars in the world. So a V12 powered one would be pretty sick. While Mazda tried and failed with Amati, other Japanese automakers were successful in their endeavors, even with the asset price bubble. What made them different? How were brands like Lexus so successful while Amati was an epic failure? Well, one of the major differences between Amati and other successful Japanese luxury badges was the timing. Honda, Toyota, and Nissan all started working on their luxury brands in the early 80s, giving them the time to get their foot in the market before the bubble burst. They knew there would be growth in the luxury car market as Americans recovered from the recession of the early 80s. And as baby boomers started getting older and having more money. Yeah, what's that like? All these factors combined meant Honda launched Acura in 1986, Toyota launched Lexus, and Nissan launched Infiniti in 1989. Arguably, the most successful of all three was Lexus. Yeah, so Toyota started working on their luxury badge in 1983. The chairman of Toyota, Eiji Toyoda, told the company he wanted them to build the world's best car. The project was codenamed F1 for Flagship One. Clearly, having a cool code name is a big part of getting into the luxury car business. Flagship One developed the Lexus LS400.
One of the most important cars in the history of cars.
That's right, James. The team behind Lexus spent time on focus groups and market research. They set up their headquarters, I think, their design headquarters, was it in Newport Beach?
Laguna Beach.
Laguna Beach. Yes, it was. It was Laguna Beach. Thank you, James. Like we mentioned earlier, part of the F1 team rented a house in Laguna Beach. Oh, right there. It's in the script. And took notes on how rich Americans spent their money. The F1 team also spent time prototype testing on the German Autobahn. When they said they wanted to build the world's best car, they weren't kidding, Joe.
Well, that's where Mazda got it wrong. They set up their headquarters in Glendale outside of Phoenix.
Outside of Phoenix. Oh, Glendale, Arizona.
Oh no. Yeah. The second best Glendale.
The second best Glendale.
Do you know that Glendale translates to Valley Valley? Glen and Dale both mean valley.
I'm going to name my sons Glen and Dale.
Anyway, Acura, meanwhile, was able to capitalize on the market reach of Honda to put up impressive numbers in the 80s. In their first year in business, they sold over 100,000 cars, soon outpacing the output of companies like Mercedes-Benz, BMW, and even Lexus. While Acura's performance would suffer during the lost decade to come, Acura would see a resurgence in popularity as their so-called tuner cars, like the Integra, became popular with younger customers. Interestingly enough, neither Acura nor Infiniti, Nissan's luxury badge, were used in the Japanese domestic market. Instead, Honda and Nissan's higher-end cars were part of the parent company's lineup. Infiniti got off to a slower start than Lexus and Acura, failing to find the same level of enthusiasm for its offerings, which lacked the panache of Lexus and Acura. The brand has never really found its footing, announcing in 2019 that it would depart the Western European market to focus on China and the United States. Still, at least Infiniti had a chance, unlike Amati. I mean, what's like the most recognizable Infiniti that you can think of? Like the first one that comes to mind for
G35,
me.
G35.
Yeah, G35 and G37.
That's my literally least favorite car.
Yeah, you don't like them. I wanted one really bad in high school. I thought they were so cool.
So, You just don't like the styling of the G35?
I think it looks bad, and then I think, like, the majority of the G35s that I've seen, I don't like. They're modded poorly. Although, a G35 sedan with a six-speed, that's a cool car, man.
I would love that.
That's a cool friggin' car.
Yeah, I don't think that first-gen G35 has aged super well. It's pretty blocky.
The back looks like a boat.
I like the back. I like those taillights. I remember in high school, my buddy Vishal, he had a G35. He was like a couple years older. He was on the track team. Or he did like throwing with me. I was like, damn, Vishal's cool. It was like a gunmetal gray, but he had like darker gunmetal gray wheels with it. It looked so sick. It was tight.
I think like the cool older dude in high school that hangs out with you and likes cars is such an influence.
Like,
for the rest of your life. Like, mine is like this dude Cam and this dude Liam, who are a couple years older than me. Cam had a Mark IV GTI with exhaust lowered and wheels on stock wheels. And then Liam had a black E30 325IS with the plastic bumpers lowered on ASEV Type A's. Like, they're like these like chunky five spokes. And like, to this day, that's the coolest car to me. Like, an E30 lowered on chunky five spokes is the coolest car. And they smoked cigarettes. And like, we didn't hang out. But like, when I saw them at like Big Rock, which was like the park we all like hung out at, like, they'd be like, yo, what's up, Pumphrey? How's your GTI? I'd be like, yeah, that's Oh, it's good, Liam. How's your rich dad and your stepmom?
Yeah, I had a Buick Skylark in high school, and needless to say, I set the trend for the next frosh coming in.
As much as Mazda had big ambitions, they had bad timing and not enough money. In hindsight, trying to compete with brands like Lexus and Acura seems like a bad idea. But Mazda was scrappy and didn't want to admit defeat. But with a combination of the economic downfall of Japan and oversaturation in the luxury car market, and not market testing with the Real Housewives of Laguna Beach, maybe Amati was destined to fail.
Perhaps the biggest point of disappointment around the Amati badge is all of the what could have beens. Mazda was so shamed by its failure, we have very little information about the whole project. The only reason we have any information about it is because of very enthusiastic car journalists doing deep dives and former employees of the American side of Mazda giving some interviews. But Mazda destroyed most of it, the promotional material, and refuses to talk about Amati. In all this, we see that even if you build the best car with the best engine, sometimes factors bigger than a single car company, global politics, an economic collapse, and an oversaturation of the market means it doesn't matter how good a car is. Amati probably never had a shot, but we'll never know. Maybe Amati will live again. Mazda could use a reboot of some sort, with the future of cars looking increasingly electric, and Infiniti recently announcing its entire range will be electric or hybrid. Maybe a 2031 all-electric version of Amati could be in the future.
Hmm, interesting.
I have a hot take.
What's your hot take, James?
So, like, even though all of these other Japanese luxury brands were intended for the American market,
mm-hmm.
They were very Japan. They are very Japanese. Like, Lexus is very much Toyota. Acura is very much Honda, to the extent that, like, they sell Lexus and Acura models in Japan as Toyota and Honda.
Mm-hmm.
I think Mazda allowing Ford to be its daddy ruined any chance of Amati. Because like, the reason that these Japanese car brands worked is because they came in and they raised the curve. And they were like, hey, America, this is what's possible. Right? So, like, you know, it's like the same reason you don't take money from investors unless you can spend it, because you're, like, diluting your influence. Like, I think Ford killed Amati. I think Ford is the reason that Mazda hasn't made, like, another RX car and hasn't been as successful as it could have been, because, like what was Ford making in the 90s? Ford was making...
Do you think that Lincoln, the Lincoln of this era, could have conflicted with the Amati if it would have come out?
I don't think they did it on purpose necessarily. I just think they were, like, bad at it, and it seems like Mazda gave Ford too much respect and listened to them too much.
Okay.
That's my hot take.
That could be.
That's my real house.
Mazda today, I mean, they're independent.
They're independent now, but, like, they're also, like, I've been to Mazda a number of times and, like, met with them, and they're very, like, yeah, we're small. And we're good being small. Like, we're okay.
I love their current lineup. I think the CX-5 is, like, one of the best cars that you can buy today. I firmly believe that.
Yeah, Casey's one of her best friends was, like, just had a baby and was like, what car should I get? And they ended up buying a CX-5.
I would have a CX-5. My mom said two of them. They're great cars.
Yeah, their design language is amazing. They're some of the best looking, I say economy cars in quotes. But yeah, they're one of the best looking affordable cars.
I tried to get my little sister to buy a CX-5 because, you know, like, if you ask people that don't have cars as their hobbies what they want in a car, they all describe the CX-5. You know, like, short, not huge so you can park it, but enough space that you can utilize it in that sense. And then, you know, like, not severe design language enough. Like, it's a car for the masses.
And I want all the tech stuff
yep.
from, like, nice cars and, like, a nice interior that makes me feel proud of myself because I'm buying a new car.
So it's, you know, the Amati wasn't Mazda. It was kind of, I wonder where it would have been if Mazda would have been around today, if they would have, you know, bit the bullet and went through with this project. So I'm glad that they didn't.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for listening. Good episode. If you'd like to email us, hit us up at passgas@donutmedia.com. We'd love to hear from you. Tune in next week. Do you guys have anything you want to plug?
New merch. Huge. We're leveling up our merch game. Huge. It was already sick. It's about to get, honestly, guys, I'm not exaggerating, 1,000% sicker.
Dude, we've seen some of these designs and they are amazing. I can't wait to get my hands on all these shirts.
We have a dude working for us that's amazing. Mo Power Baby redesign, high-low merch. I'm not quite sure when everything's dropping, but the best way to not miss it is just go to donutmedia.com and join our mailing list. You get a discount on stuff for doing that. And
a 10%?
We promise we won't. Yeah, 10%. And we promise we won't be annoying about it. It's literally just getting an email when new drops. So do that. And watch our videos on YouTube, please.
All right. Be kind.
Fire up that wink wink juice.
Fire up that wink wink juice. And I have no idea what's going on with my dog.
All right. See you later.